Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Onofawakin.
Welcome to 2014, guys. Great to hear you both in the new year. On this week's show, we're going to be talking about a new Pebble Watch, cloud gaming on Sony PlayStation, T-Mobile wants to pay you to switch, Facebook is dead to teens, apparently, our digital music downloads already obsolete, and the legacy of the NSA leaks. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. Join us on Facebook and Twitter at The Drill Down. Our show's also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and you can search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week, and in this case, over the holidays. And one of the things I want to talk about is some of the holiday things that I've been playing with, and one of them right off the bat is Tomb Raider, which I picked up via a Steam sale over the holidays. It's not a new game. In fact, I think it's 2012, I believe, but Steam had it on one of their sales, and I snatched it up. And I have to say that I'm really quite impressed with this game.
Yeah, Tosin, isn't this one of your favorites?
Yeah, this is one of my recommendations for last year. It's really an amazing game that I think has really flown under the radar. So
yeah.
Tell me a little bit more about your experience with it so far.
Well, I would say that on a scale of 1 to 100, if 100 is your typical Valve game like Portal or Half-Life 2, Tomb Raider is a solid 85. It's got an incredible, engaging storyline. Very simple game mechanics to pick up. You can get started and get rolling on Tomb Raider within a matter of minutes, and it feels very intuitive. The environments are just breathtaking. There's a scene. There's kind of a showcase scene very early on where Lara Croft, who's the heroine of Tomb Raider, is finds herself shipwrecked, and she's standing on a cliff overlooking the shipwreck of her ship. And you get this sort of 360 panorama around her, and it's just breathtaking to look at. And it's all it's not a cinematic. It's all in-game animation, and it's just a showcase for whatever system you're on. And the game has a terrific, like I said, storyline, and really engaging, and a lot of fun to play. So I obsessed over it for a good couple of weeks. It took me a good couple of weeks, off and on. It's not a short game, but it's not a very long game. It actually is kind of a long game.
Yeah, there are a lot of extras in there that you can seek out if that's your sort of thing. I think one that's also really pretty telling about this iteration of Lara Croft is that it's an origin story, and it as a female character, you know, often you'll see these weak portrayals, and here.
Yeah.
That, you know, at some point you just feel like a total badass, that you are really, you know, you may have come from a point of weakness, but you've really learned, adapted, and become strong based off the struggles.
Yeah, that's the other thing I forgot to point that out, that it is an origin story. And Lara Croft gets the shit beaten out of her throughout this game. It's really sort of a test of wills for your character, and you feel it every time that she gets beaten up, basically. So moving on from that, The other thing, one of the other things that I got this Christmas was a new mount for my iPhone. And unlike your typical cradle mount, first of all, let me backtrack. The reason I got this mount was because I had a mount, previous mount that mounted to the air filter vent. And
you're talking about a car mount, right?
We're talking about a car mount.
So you had a device that allowed your iPhone to connect to the air vent in your vehicle.
Yes.
Now the did it ever block the air coming out of your vehicle?
Yes, it did. First of all, it did block the air vent. There were a number of problems with it. It blocked the air vent. When the heater was on, it would actually trigger the temperature warning on the iPhone. So it would make the iPhone unusable sometimes.
Wow.
And the worst problem of all is it actually broke the vent. The little, you know, clamps that would clamp onto the inside of the vent broke the
vent. Wow,
the
that's like expensive to fix, too.
Yeah. So I needed a new solution for this, an entirely new solution. So I got this mount called the iMagnet, and it connects to your dash. It attaches to your dash via a suction cup, essentially, like a very sort of sticky suction cup. And on the other end, the end that attaches to your iPhone is a high-powered magnet, and the way that that grabs onto your iPhone is you either stick a supplied metal plate onto your the back of your iPhone or your iPhone case, or in my case, I have one of these sort of neoprene cases on my iPhone, and they give you a small metal disc. So you place the metal disc in between the iPhone and the case, and the magnet grabs onto the disc. So,
wow.
Yeah. I have to say it works like a charm.
I mean, it's got great reviews online. It's on Amazon with 682 customer reviews that average at 4.5 stars. Of those 682 reviews, 518 of them are 5-star.
Yeah. Yeah, the only thing I've heard negative about it, and I have not yet experienced this, is that I have heard that it can sometimes throw off your compass. And I don't know if that's the case, or I have not experienced that yet. So,
how's the suction cup?
Suction cup is great. I have it on a... I had a mount previous that included a base, like this flat plastic base that attaches via adhesive to my dash, and so I use that flat plastic base for the suction part, so it's stuck there pretty much like glue. It's not coming off.
Okay.
But otherwise the suction part is a combination of suction and sort of the sticky gummy material that ensures that it gets into the crevices of your textured dash.
That's cool. Yeah. I mean, I really wish they, it'd be nice if the next version of the iPhone had the same sort of, what is it called? The magnetic charging. There's a term for it. And I don't know why I don't have it in my head right now as a geek. I feel really embarrassed about it, but, the idea that you can place your phone right on top of a thing like this and get it charged up, mm-hmm. like you can with the Nexus 5 or any of the Lumia devices, would be sweet. But unfortunately, I have a fingerprint sensor that forgets my fingers.
And the other thing, the last thing I wanted to mention was Apple's 12 Days of Gifts, which was an app that they offered through the App Store. And
that was fun. I used that myself.
Yeah. So by way of that, essentially what happened was that every day after the 25th of December, you would receive a new free gift from Apple, either an album, a book, an app, or I'm trying to remember what else there was.
It was a game.
Yeah, it was different.
All sorts of soft goods from the Apple Store.
Right.
Whether it was you know, straight up music or movies or TV shows, mm-hmm. or actual, you know, interactive software. It was very well done.
Yeah.
It was very well done.
Yeah. And it was a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to next year's 12 Days of Gifts. I hope that this is a recurring promotion. And it was a lot of fun. Dwayne, how about yourself? What have you been playing with this over the holidays?
So our buddy Davinja Hardware got me a pretty great thing. It's it was just a subscription to Comixology, not a subscription, but a gift card.
Yeah.
I've been a big fan of Comixology. I own a couple of comic books on DVD, which were fun for the computer, and I tried to go through this whole process to get them onto my iPad, and sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. But Comixology has really become a go-to for me as a guy who enjoys comics, enjoys Discovery, enjoys, you know, basically a nice quick read, a little escape every Wednesday or so. The one he recommended to me was Saga, so I bought a bunch of those, and I've been reading a lot of the various X-Men lines, especially there's a X-Men 4, and it's about the females of Xavier School and how they're running about the guys and all this stuff. So it was just a great gift because I was able to use that to kind of catch up on stories, and that was a lot of fun. That was my big haul. Obviously, I got some other stuff, but none of it was techie, so I don't want to bore you.
Sure. Toastin, anything that you played with over the holidays? Any tech gifts that you got under the tree?
I think one of the things that I'd probably like to mention is there were a lot of Steam sales that were going on, and I got several things gifted through Steam.
Uh-huh.
And one of the games that I've been playing of late, it's called Monaco. Have you heard of it before?
Yeah, I have heard of this. This is like you know what? I'm confusing this with Tropico. I'm sorry. So what is Monaco?
So it's basically, I'd probably call it like an indie heist game. So you have this sort of top-down view into this, you know, place, be it a building or something else. And you have various characters that you can play as. So the graphics are not your standard typical set of graphics. Kind of blocky character shapes. But each of these characters has a specific skill set. So, for example, there's the mole who can knock down walls. And there's the cleaner who, if he sneaks up on someone, puts them to sleep. And the goal of each sort of mission is to be able to either like steal money or get something from the specific location, and you only have a certain sort of visual sense of what's kind of in front of you, kind of a visual cone of light, and everything else kind of adapts and changes. Guards will go on rounds, and it's a cooperative game that's a lot of fun. I've been playing with a couple friends, and it's just been really unique in trying to do the various puzzle solving and kind of improvising as well. So it's pretty cool. I definitely recommend checking it out.
I'm looking at the Steam page for Monaco, and it is like a top down, like low tech, like low res co-op heist game.
Yeah, but it's a seriously, it's a good time. And you know, something else what I've actually been doing of late is kind of reflecting on the gadgets that I own and kind of what I deem my favorite gadget of all of them. And one of them was actually a corporate gift a couple years ago. And I realized that is my iPad mini. And I realized that that's the one item that I use constantly, be it on the couch or on airplanes. That's a device that I spend hours on at a time. And I think it's kind of it's lived up the testament of time and really been the kind of device that I'd recommend anyone.
iPad mini.
Yeah. And I guess the final thing to really mention is, we continued our machete ordering of Star Wars. I know I've mentioned this a while ago when we watched both A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back. We watched Episode 2, Attack of the Clones, just the other day. And surprisingly, a couple of them really enjoyed it, actually. And so for me, it's been a long time since I watched Attack of the Clones, and I think I've probably only seen it once or twice, maybe. And I think it's a lot better than how I recall it. Now, that's, of course, this is episode 2. I think it still has a lot of flaws.
I don't think I remember anything about that movie.
Yeah. It has a lot of flaws, but I think so far in the context of the Machete Order,
yeah,
you know, it kind of adds a little bit more insight into characters that develop later.
Isn't that the one that you can take Attack of the Clones completely out of?
No, you take out the Phantom Menace, but you need Attack of the Clones.
Right.
I've actually been watching the Machete Order with my girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Slowly, what do you think
so far?
It's the order that makes the most sense. I think that I would, if I were to do it again, I would watch it with all six, though. I would watch 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 6. That's how I would do it. I think that the first movie does have something to offer, even though it does have a couple cringeworthy parts. Anakin's evolution is important. And I think that even though they failed in many ways when it comes to the portrayal of it, you still need some of it to understand the dynamic between this anti-hero slash villain and his wife. And you need to see that from the time that, you know, he's much less mature than her to when he gets older, seems as mature, but is indeed still much less mature than her.
Yeah.
So there is that. I was going to say one quick thing about your iPad mini story. It's interesting because the device has been out for about a year and a half. And you're like, I've had it for a couple of years and it's awesome. It just kind of shows how much you use it. You kind of can't. It seems like it's been around longer than it has because you use it so often. And it's just such a part of your daily life. So that to me stuck out as cool. I have that same feeling about my full-sized iPad. I got one in 2011, toward the end of 2011, and it is definitely my go-to device. I've actually, you know, tried to like separate myself from my iPad. I've tried other tablets like the Nexus 7 and stuff.
Likewise, I've tried Nexus 7 as well.
Yeah, too. And they're not, you know, it's not bad. They're not bad devices, but I just find that the iPad is really quite a powerful device for my my casual needs. When it comes to computer, I just reach for the iPad. That's what I do.
Right.
Yeah. Although I will say that with my Pebble, the watch, that has made me use my iPhone much more. I used to use my iPhone only for when I was out, and the iPad did everything when I was in. But now, because I can control music and everything from my wrist while I'm cooking or whatever, I tend to use the iPhone a bit more. So it's...
All right, well, let's talk about some of the headlines. Before we jump into the headlines of 2014, I have to mention last year ended on a dark note as Target reported a data breach impacting 40 million credit and debit card accounts used at their retail stores between November 27th, Black Friday, and December 15th, 2013. The type of data stolen, also known as track data, allows crooks to create counterfeit cards by encoding the information on any card with a magnetic stripe. So, in other words, they would theoretically be able to reproduce stolen debit cards and use them to withdraw cash from ATMs. Credit card companies are still responding in 2014, reissuing new cards to affect customers. I got my new card last week. Because apparently my Chase card was affected. So
I think any card that was being, I think they basically said that if you used a card at Target, you should ask for a new one from your
issuer.
Especially if you used a bank card.
Yeah.
That's like the big problem. If you're using your debit card at a place like Target, the fact is they gained access to, you know, the swipe information.
Yeah.
And they may well gain access to an encrypted form, but still a form of the PIN that you entered. And that's really where it becomes kind of a problem, because you don't, while with a credit card, you know, someone steals your credit card, you use this thing in Germany, oh shit, okay, credit card helped me out, I don't have to pay that for 60 days anyway. With your bank card, that money's out of your account immediately, and that really sucks.
Yeah. Right. Now, when it happened to you, Andy, did they specifically mention Target, or was it just we realized that your card may have been compromised?
Yeah, it was a very general statement. They said your card may have been compromised as a safety precaution. We're reissuing your card, and the old one is no longer valid.
Right. Yeah, I actually got the same thing just the other day for my bank card. Not that I've shopped at Target since November 3rd. Uh-huh. Actually, I remember that because I was sick and getting medicine. Kind of interesting to note that
it's a bank card issue. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And this is a big thing because the technology that you use in other places, like the chip versus the swipe technology,
right,
helps to prevent this kind of breach. Now, it doesn't solve the problem, but it's certainly like when you're in Europe and you go to a restaurant, they bring a little device over to you, and there are two ways to input a card. You can either put the whole thing in the device, or you can swipe the device like we do here in the States. And that different technology, that technology that uses a smart chip, is a lot harder to extract from the card. And so there's been some pressure and some debate in Congress even about why we don't have that and what sorts of measures need to be put in place to make sure that these companies credit card companies are forcing this kind of change, and that the guys who have to buy these point of sale devices do the upgrading, and that people like Target, who, in addition to buying the point of sale devices, they also have to make sure that their data is encrypted and protected, and figuring out standards for that encryption and protection, just like banks have standards for their data. Or that, you know, HIPAA certification, that kind of thing, for credit card data for these retail locations. So there's a lot of stuff being talked about from a federal regulation point, I guess, which shows the maturity of this digital information that we have, to the point where the government wants to figure out how to set up standards for its protection, just like your medical information.
Yeah, this was the largest breach of its kind.
Ever.
So I think it was kind of a wake up call for credit cards, physical credit cards used at brick and mortar stores.
Right. We've seen the virtual goods stores like Sony store and everything get breached before. And you're like, oh, well, it's online, whatever. But the idea that you can go into a store, swipe your stuff, put it in a thing on a pin pad, and someone can steal it from wherever they were. That's scary.
Yeah. Moving to 2014. The New Year's Consumer Electronics Show kicked off to a promising start as Pebble announced an upgrade to their hardware. The new Pebble Steel features a stainless steel body with Corning Gorilla Glass covering the screen instead of plastic. There is a natural brush stainless finish option, and also one featuring a black matte physical vapor deposition treatment. That's where they they build the model out of vapor deposition as opposed to one block of stainless steel. The Intel Surface was built that way. The Pebble Steel also has an LED indicator for showing battery charge and is both waterproof and features a battery that lasts up to a week, just like the original. The new Pebble Steel retails for $249, which is $100 more than the standard Pebble.
No, it's twice as much. The standard Pebble is $125. This is literally double the money at $250.
Wow!
And it also has a different, a slightly different type of display that's supposed to be somewhat more luminescent.
Really, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. But the good news is, I think we talked about this before the show. This is pretty much the iPhone 3G of Pebble. New factor, new look. Yeah. More accessible. I mean, I love my Pebble. I was talking about it earlier, and I think the Pebble Steel looks really good. I'm happy with my model. I have the orange Kickstarter version. This is something that more people are going to want to get their hands on. And even though it costs more, like the iPhone 3G, which was cheaper, I think it has more mass appeal like the iPhone 3G had. It's basically the same innards, inside of the device. It's just that it's got more of a watch type feel. This is the direction that Google needs to go in with its Glass product, and this is the direction that Apple went with the original iPhone product. They changed the antenna and they changed the case. Here, Pebble's changing the display and changing the case, and they made it more palatable to everybody else.
Right. Really nice aluminum or steel. I think it's aluminum case, glass and aluminum instead of glass and plastic.
Right. Yeah. And it's a tougher type of glass, which everybody knows. Everybody's into this whole Gorilla Glass situation and how tough it is. And as a watch user, because I was out of the watch market for 5 years because I had a phone, it matters. It matters to you guys too, right, that a watch is a little bit tougher.
Absolutely. No. In fact, my Pebble, Kickstarter Pebble here, suffered from a little surface damage from scratching it against the walls, which, you know, it's because I'm not used to wearing a watch for having not worn it for a long time, and I ended up having to get one of those, scratch resistant covers for the Pebble.
Yeah, no, I think this, as you kind of said, Dwayne, this has really large mass appeal. I know a lot of impulse buys were made in my office, and talking to one of my colleagues, they really mentioned who currently has a Pebble but bought the steel version. He noted that it's the Pebble in its current form isn't a device that he tends to like to wear in public to, you know, like fancy dinners, things of that nature.
It's kind of like the Swatch watch of its type.
Yeah. Now, what I actually found really interesting and maybe something to reflect on is there was an article online, and I may have to dig it up, where they kind of mentioned the Pebble, the reiteration of the Pebble being more for guys and it being a guy's device now.
I disagree with that so much.
On the band and stuff like that.
But I just disagree with that so much. I mean, frankly, the Pebble's never been a gendered device, and if it were gendered, it would be a guy's device. The marketing materials never show a female. It's all the guys who are making the device, holding it, wearing it, showing it off, whatever. So it's always been a dude's device. The idea that now that it's steel makes it a guy's device goes back to a lot of the problems in tech when it comes to the way guys view themselves.
Interesting. I was just curious your take. I mean, that makes sense that it has always been advertised as – well, actually, let me take that back. I do remember one ad where they were showing an integration with a running app where they did show it
on a female was running. That's true. I'll give you that. I will say, though, that Pebble has to move in this direction for a couple reasons, the first of which is last year – even though it seems like it was out of the rumor mill alone, there was a lot of pressure coming from the fact that Apple might show up with an app. And if it did...
Right. They're running against the clock, essentially, by all of these other competitors who were ready to... who they knew were going to be heading in this direction with wearable tech.
Yeah, or even came out with them, like Samsung.
Right.
A couple other smartwatches have come out as well.
Yeah.
And those watches have focused on aesthetics over functionality, and they're making an impact in the market, which is certainly what Apple would have done. They would have said, maybe it does more, but the fact is it could do less, and it has an Apple logo on it, and yada, yada, yada. So they had to move in this direction to stave off the competition. And then there's the fact that my mom was going to buy me a watch this year because she saw my Pebble, and she said, that's not really a grown-up's watch. That's a kid's watch. Look at the orange. The fact that Pebble can come out with a $250 watch that does all that it does, it actually spikes competition with those guys who are throwing out $300, $400 watches in the quote of nice watch category. The low-end jewelry watches, they get hit pretty hard by the fact that the Pebble has a fairly sustainable body type, a very long live battery, and it's working with the digital age. I can completely see a Tag Heuer or a couple others, Fossil especially, those kind of guys, trying to chase down Pebble now that Pebble's come out with the new form factor.
Also at CES, Sony announced PlayStation Now, which is a service that will bring streaming PlayStation games not only to the PS4, but to the PS3, the Vita, and even televisions, tablets, and smartphones. This is the company's public-facing brand for Gaikai, the cloud gaming technology it purchased in June 2012, which the company previously said would bring PS3 games to the PlayStation 4 and Vita. The full service will let users rent games or pay for a subscription that will let them explore a range of titles. This sounds very familiar. This sounds just like OnLive, which was Gaikai's competitor before Sony purchased them. Sony will launch a closed beta in the U.S. at the end of the month and plans to roll out the service more broadly at the end of the summer. What do you guys think about this?
It seems pretty awesome. I'd have to say it's definitely a good move to make, because that was one of the major concerns with the new consoles, was the inability to play a lot of the classic PS3 games. Uh-huh. Having no backwards compatibility. And here, not only have they brought backwards compatibility to the PlayStation 4, they've also involved it with the rest of Sony's ecosystem. So there's really been an expansion here, right?
Yeah.
They breathe new life into existing devices. I mean, Tosin's absolutely right.
I'm really curious about how it will integrate into Sony devices that are not console gaming devices, because over the holidays we got a Sony Blu-ray player, and the Blu-ray player has more or less the same cross-media bar as interface as the PS3, and the Blu-ray player also has a lot of set-top box functionality. It will stream all the major services: Netflix, Hulu, Vudu. And it will also uses DLNA to, it can access my Drobo media server as well. So it's more or less mirrors the same streaming and DLNA functionality as my PS3. And I'm wondering if you could play PlayStation Now games on this Blu-ray device.
Yeah, I think it'll come down to the controller and compatibility mm-hmm. between the PS4 controller and other devices. I already hear from a lot of people that the PS4 controller may really even be the controller of choice when playing things like Steam on your PC, because you can connect it a lot easier via Bluetooth than you could with the PS3 as well as the Xbox 360. So I've heard glowing recommendations for it. And so I think that's really going to be where everything spins off of.
Yeah, it's also a big deal because, let's face it, any other company, I'm just going to say this, any other company would have taken this new technology and they would have implemented it in the PS4 and left it at that.
Yeah.
The fact that this is going into the existing device, the PS3, which Sony knows still has a lot of life left in it.
Yes.
And it's not being used as a trick, or not a trick, but it's not being used as a tactic to get people to move on to the PS4. Is a big deal. Now, as someone said, the PS4 really needed this. When you boast about the power of your new device and then tell people that it can't play the games of the old device, you're lying to them because they're geeks, right?
Yeah.
And the fact that it can use the power of the internet, the high bandwidth rates, and its own internal processors to pull this kind of thing off is an important deal. I mean, people want the value. In an age of intellectual property and DRM and stuff like that, you know, people are not – they don't have a problem with having to pay for their media. They have a problem with paying for media and then knowing that they can't access it because you no longer support the format that it came in.
Remember the Xbox currently – well, the Xbox One currently does not have backwards compatibility.
Right, which is rare, because Microsoft, its biggest crutch for the last 10 years has been the fact that, you know, if you bought a Microsoft product today – Windows has been backward compatible ever since the days of Doom. For the last 10 years, you can play anything. You can do anything. You can run almost any program in a compatibility mode. So the fact that the Microsoft Xbox doesn't have that backward compatibility is just strange. In fact, the only company I can think of out of the top of my head that openly acknowledges a lack of backward compatibility for the purposes of moving you forward has been Apple ever since OS X was released. You know, getting rid of Rosetta and all those things like that.
Yeah.
So I think it's this is the right move, especially when they talk about being for gamers.
I'm really curious as to see how what the lag time is, how what the latency is on these games, because the games are actually not being played locally. They're being played over the over their server, central server, and the video frames are being streamed via the cloud to you. So, and I know that OnLive has been doing this, and it seems to be the latency on OnLive seems to be pretty workable. I don't there's not any noticeable lag that I can tell, but also the amount of users on OnLive versus the amount of potential users on PlayStation Now is the scale of this will be just exponentially quite larger. So I'm wondering how the Sony's servers are going to handle the scaling of the number of users on their system.
Even so, nobody else is even touching this, right? So even if it's crappy for a little while, it's still better than the alternative, which is to say give up your old collection or keep another box under your thing until it breaks. That sucks.
The other thing I'm hoping for is that they offer owners of PS3 games the PS4 the ability to play them on your PS4 for a relatively low price, because we've already paid for it.
You mentioned that you were playing around Ultraviolet and or Voodoo, one of those services, and you got to put in your old discs, and for $5 you got a whole bunch of those movies back or whatever.
Yeah, that I got like for $100, I got about 40 plus videos at high definition. Maybe it was like 50. Yeah, it was close to 50 because it ended up being $250 each, right. Which is a terrific price for
upgrading your stuff.
Yeah,
basically,
yeah.
It's not just you're getting it digitally; you're getting an upgrade. So that's where the money is.
1080p.
1080p. If they can do that with these games that are being served from their servers, where they control all the DRM, they know who's doing it, that they owned it, and all that stuff. If they could give you that kind of compatibility, you throw in your old disc,
yep,
and then boom, it's up there. That's the kind of thing that's really going to make this platform take off, and I actually think that Microsoft will have to follow suit.
I agree. It's going to be a gauntlet being thrown down. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on here. Intel's latest microcomputer is a full Linux computer called the Edison, which Intel has announced at CES. It's no bigger than an SD card. In addition to full Linux support and dual-core x86-compatible Quark processor, the Edison features built-in Wi-Fi, Bluetooth LE, its own app store, and an onboard microcontroller to process data in real time. Intel mainly envisions the new Edison as a vehicle for building wearable computing devices. It's the perfect size and shape for a new generation of wearables that'll come with powerful computing capabilities on board. There's an op-ed piece on this in Read Write by, and get the author's name here, Alex Salkever. What Intel's Edison means, one card to smarten up dumb gadgets and to connect them all. And he talks about the Internet of Things, which was the idea that everything would be connected by via the Internet in one way, shape, or form somehow. Like, everything would be given its own IP address. And he says that the Internet of Things concept suffers somewhat from questions of scale and connectivity, in part because there's just not enough gadgets around that are ready and able to connect with each other. But when it becomes very, very easy and justifiable to add a tiny computer to lots of devices, as with this new Edison device, then the idea of device-powered cloud becomes far more viable because of the vast increase in potentially addressable compute capacity. And similarly, the prospect of ubiquitous tiny computers could dethrone the smartphone from its emerging role as a hub device for the Internet of Things. And that's a good thing, he says. Essentially, if you can move the network node structure out of the smartphone and into anything that's connected or that can be connected to a relatively intelligent and configurable computer, then all of a sudden a true mesh network emerges, one that's most likely much less dependent on human interaction to function, because no one has to take out their phone out of their pocket to make the thing go.
I read that, and I'm kind of like, yes and no.
Mm-hmm.
On some level, the phone has become the hub that the PC used to be. You used to plug your phone into your PC. Now my Fitbit connects to my phone so it can go out to the internet, right?
Yeah.
These devices are going to be small, and they're going to be great. I really think so. But they're not going to be able to connect directly to the internet without the kind of service charges associated with that. Now, there are people out there like John Gruber who say smartwatches aren't smart because they don't have direct connection to, like, Wi-Fi or to, like, cellular connections and everything like that. I think that's actually really untrue. Something becomes smart when a computer gets into it. A smartphone is a phone with a computer based in it. You name any other smart device, it's basically the same thing with a computer. And Intel's being able to do this on a level that is so much smaller than what we've got today, it's really quite attractive. A smart TV, a TV with computing in it, right?
Yeah.
So what we're looking at is something that could revolutionize the way all of our embedded devices work. Imagine if Fitbit would connect directly to Wi-Fi, or just imagine if Fitbit could be that much smaller. It can be so tiny you didn't have to wear it as a thing around your wrist. It could be a little patch you put on the bottom of your watch.
Sure.
Or it could be a little patch you put on the inside of your phone, something like that. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have to be in a pocket or whatever. But it would still probably connect to the telephone because it has to get out to the internet. This idea that people won't have to touch these things, that's also not true, because everything needs power, so you're going to have to plug stuff in, and it's going to complain to you when you don't plug it in. And that's one of the things here. Intel is moving. Intel missed the boat. Andy and I were listening to a story earlier today on NPR, Morning Edition, where basically Intel was compared to GM or Ford back in the 90s. They were making these big gas-guzzling trucks. Everybody was into it. And then suddenly the gas crisis came. I'm sorry, back in the 70s. Big gas-guzzling muscle cars. Then the gas crisis shows up. And Honda and Toyota begin eating everyone's lunch because
right.
They have these really small, very efficient cars that sip gas and get you from A to B, which changed the dynamic. Intel said that these ARM processors weren't going to do the trick. People want power, and Windows, the old Windows mobile, was the way to go when it came to smart. And they failed. They bought Danger. They tried to convert it to .NET, put Intel chips in it. Microsoft bought Danger, converted to .NET, their Wintel shop, and they failed. This whole thing just shows that they were off the mark. These new Edison chips,
mm-hmm.
They are kind of like the descendant of Atom. By that I mean ATOM, Intel's second attempt at a low-powered device that ran the netbook generation for so long,
right.
Which was then again usurped by these ARM chips and iPads and iPhones and things like that. So this Edison stuff really could be Intel's saving grace. They don't require Windows. They can run on Linux, and let's face it, everything is running on some sort of Unix right now. OS X is running on a Unix. Android is running on a Unix version of Linux. And that's why I think Intel's really, everyone should be relatively optimistic about this, because if they can get developers on board, they can really get some traction here.
Yeah.
You could have smart socks. In fact,
yeah.
What they were talking about, there are companies now making onesies for babies
uh-huh.
that involve the Intel Edison technology. So your onesie, the onesie basically tells you how your baby's vitals are. You don't have to worry about SIDS as
right.
much.
It's like
right?
a Fitbit for babies. It's a Fitbit and a baby monitor all in one.
Exactly. When your baby begins to wake up, it's a world where your baby begins to wake up. It's stirring in its crib. And the bottle warmer automatically turns on because it knows your baby's stirring. In fact, it's going to not only just take the information that your baby's stirring, it's going to be able to create a graph of your baby's sleep patterns. And that can let you know when your baby wants to sleep. So you can, figure out if you have to change that or do whatever. And this is the capability, because you can't put a bigger device like a Fitbit on a baby and have it work as effectively right now.
Right.
But something that can be embedded directly into the onesie.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's strong enough and durable enough, that's washable and everything.
Yeah,
that's great. That's a no brainer. So yeah, I think Intel's Edison stuff that is an exciting thing to see in 2014.
So this week, T-Mobile announced it'll pay your early termination fee if you agree to switch. They'll pay you up to $350 per line to cover early termination fees and release you from a contract with AT&T, Sprint, or Verizon. There are a few catches. You'll need to trade in your existing phone, buy a new T-Mobile phone, or sign up for a new T-Mobile plan. T-Mobile also won't be paying out a lump sum of $350, but rather the actual amount you pay your existing carrier if you break your contract to switch. You'll need to send proof to T-Mobile directly or mail it to the company and wait for your money. Now, last week, AT&T announced that it would pay $200 for every line that T-Mobile customers switched over to its own network, an offer that also requires those customers to buy a new AT&T phone. So the gloves are off and the knives are out between these carriers. You know, they're trying to get you to they're paying you outright to switch to each other's services.
Are they paying you outright, or they're just knocking down the walls that they themselves put up, right? Like, they had these protectionist things that say, hey, if you leave us, you're going to have to pay whatever. And then the world changes, you know. TracFone and Straight Talk and all these other guys show up with their no contract, $50 a month, whatever's. T-Mobile, AT&T, Verizon all follow suit, whether it's in their main brand or the subordinate brands. And then suddenly they're like, look, we just need the customers. We just need that in revenue. So I'll knock down the wall they put up about you leaving. And the other guy's like, well, I'll knock down the wall that they put up about you leaving. And these artificial, you know, contract termination fees are not there anymore. Now, the contract thing is weird, too, because if you're on a contract and you finish the contract and you still keep the same phone, or you go out and you buy a phone online and you just put your SIM card in or whatever, you're still paying the same money every month, right? You're still paying that $80 or $90 a month for you know, your smartphone and everything on it. So it's definitely a little strange that these barriers exist. Now, I know in some ways these barriers, these early termination fees are there to keep you from having that company lose out on the investment they paid for your phone.
Yeah.
But that's also going away too.
The subsidies, you can have,
yeah, the subsidies are going away. You go to Google's website and you can buy the Nexus 5 for like, you know, $300-$400 straight up. So yeah, this is an evolution that needs to happen, because these artificial barriers aren't tricking anybody. No one's being fooled by them.
Yeah. I think you're going to see that more often, is that people are going to be like, hey, you know, what is it? It doesn't, you know, bandwidth doesn't cost anything, really. It's like, it's one of those artificially trumped up charges, like printer ink.
Yeah, that's kind of where the profit is. I also think it's going to be a lot like changing your cable company or your phone company used to be before the wireless era. Now, you go to Comcast if you're on DirecTV and you're like, hey, I want to switch. DirecTV is not going to charge you anything for switching. Or if they are, Comcast is going to take care of the cost because they just want the subscriber.
Right.
It's the same thing with – that's how it used to be with Sprint and AT&T, you know. Are you going to hear the pin drop, or is it going to be, you know, the AT&T or the Baby Bells or whatever? They used to switch you right then and right there. You kept the same number and everything. So that kind of competition needs to come to the wireless space. And they need to fight for customers.
That's what it's all about, is that it's the fight for customers. It's going to be the battle for subscribers from here on out, since all of the services are more or less on parity with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to talk about this week is called Ship of Theseus by V.M. Straka. Now, this is a little bit of a fake, because it's not really V.M. Straka is not really the author of this book. This is a book that is conceived by filmmaker J.J. Abrams and written by acclaimed novelist Doug Dorst. Ship of Theseus is the central novel within the experience that is S, a multifaceted narrative of love and mystery. It tells the mystical adventure of an equally mysterious figure who is struggling to discover his own identity. Abducted onto the eponymous ship, the main character is swept into a story that spans oceans and ports, mountains and caves, capitals and citadels. Equal parts Kafka and Lovecraft, Ship of Theseus is both a frightening adventure and a philosophical treasure hunt. Now, this is a book. The book, which is an experience, I think it can be rightfully called a literary experience. The literary experience that is S is a Christmas gift that I got this year. And this book, Ship of Theseus, is part of that experience. And I just finished reading the Audible book on that. It's really an interesting book. But so now I have to go back and using the physical book, because the physical book has all of these, has a story in and of itself written within the margins of the book. So go back and experience that. Plus there are all sorts of sort of physical artifacts within the book, like maps and charts that make up this narrative. So I recommend this book, Ship of Theseus, because it's sort of on its own, it's a fascinating story. But taken as part of the whole experience that is this narrative S, it's that central part of that. To download that free audiobook, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000 plus titles. Plus the 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. All right, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, the kids run screaming from Facebook in droves. So take a listen to this. Come on back.
I remember when I first laid eyes on you. My man Tom introduced us, but I was too shy to say hi. When I finally built up enough nerve to drop a line, you made it clear you wasn't just another MySpace mistress. I didn't take it personal when you ignored my request to be your friend. I spilled my guts and hit send. Waited 2 weeks for a response and got nothing. Honestly, it only made me want you more. Week four rolled around and I was this close to letting go, but something wouldn't let me, even though I hardly knew you. It was plain to see you were meant to lock lips. You knocked me out with the brass knuckle taps in your hips. I was on this website late night lurking when I got a message from you that was labeled urgent. You said that you weren't impressed by lame dudes with no game. All the instant messenger name, but the fact that you hit me back made me smile. You must have saw something you'd like when you were skimming through my profile. You caught me at the most pivotal moments, and now I'm emailing my love with a dozen digital roses. Just a quick approach, close it, show me some kind of sign and let me know it's time to make my move. Just a quick approach, come on girl, baby I'm one of a kind and I ain't got time to lose. Just a quick approach, pull me here, show me some kind of sign and let me know it's time to make my move. Just a quick approach, girl, baby, I'm one of a kind, and I ain't got time to lose.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafawakin. For the first time since the iTunes Store opened its doors, the U.S. music industry finished the year with a decrease in digital music sales.
Say it isn't so, Andy.
It is so. Overall, for the full year 2013, digital track sales fell 5.7% from 1.34 billion units to 1.26 billion units, according to Nielsen SoundScan. While industry executives initially refused to attribute the early signs of this year's digital sales weakness to consumers' growing appetite for streaming, in the second half of the year, many were conceding that ad-supported and paid subscription services like Pandora and Spotify were indeed cannibalizing digital sales.
Death of music.
It's not even the death of music. It's the shift in music. And Apple itself has jumped into this fray with the iOS 7 iTunes Radio piece.
Yep.
So it's not like it's a whole bunch of analysts making bad decisions. The analysts at Apple have realized that buying Lala, doing all this other stuff, buying Lala wasn't enough. You know, iTunes Max wasn't enough. People don't want to deal with storage. It's It's one of the reasons why the Apple TV works so well. And people want to be able to just stream the stuff, which is why Pandora has 70 million active users, which is why iHeartRadio has 180 million users. Not all of them are active. I mean, this is – the future is not in – you know, is in the Netflix model.
Right. I was being facetious.
Yes. Oh, sorry.
No, I heartily agree there. Like, as you can see, that's just totally where the direction is going. And I think you know, it's another one of those instances where they'll continue to adapt, and it's not going to completely, you know, kill off sales, but you right. may continually see a dip.
I actually think that there might be a this might help create the market for high def digital music sales, and by that I mean there are those FLAC recordings and other recordings that hang around at much higher bit rates, much higher quality, like DVD audio quality. Than the digital files that we're used to working with. And for people who don't just want streaming music but that are aficionados, those become the vinyls of the digital age. People who want to spend $6 or $7 on a track because it's that concert that just discovered that Michael Jackson was in 1990, whatever, you know, and they're willing to pay the money for that. These are the kinds of things that will motivate more sales. So it works on both ends. And like everything else, that regular income means that, you know, the subscription income means that more people are getting paid and there's going to be less piracy going on.
Right, right, right. What fascinates me about this is that the turnaround time between mediums here. Now, I remember, like, you know, from what I understand of music history, sheet music had a long reign. I'm talking about in terms of sales, and in terms of publishing sales, sheet music had a long reign, and then it was supplanted by.
Happy Birthday is the perfect example of sheet music having a long reign. That was the intellectual property problem of the early 20th century.
Right.
Irving Berlin put Happy Birthday, the song by his two sisters in Kentucky, in one of his musicals, and they successfully sued him, or their estate sued him. Because he took their sheet music, he took their melody, and even though it was a song that everybody sang, it was theirs. And the sheet music was how that was protected. And that was pre-recording industry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Recording industry shows it up, and they've got a new awesome technology, the vinyl. You can't do anything about that. But once CDs and the other stuff show up, the same problem shows up again. But I digress. But yeah. Sheet music was the original copyrightable super thing that people consumer purchased music came in the form of sheet music as people had skills to play the piano.
It had a fairly long reign, and then it was supplanted by the LP, by records, and that also had in itself of quite a long reign too, only to be replaced eventually by compact discs. Cassettes were in there too, but cassettes I think were existed concurrently with records for a while.
Yeah, cassettes were definitely a middling technology, and there was some copyright concern regarding cassettes because you could copy on them. But the biggest thing about that was that cassettes were so clearly low definition compared to vinyl and CDs that the industry cared far less about it. There wasn't a mass production, and there wasn't the ability to easily copy them until the late 90s.
Right. When CDs came around, and CDs had a good 20, maybe 30-year lifespan, I think. I'm trying to remember what the...
20. It was about 20 years of them being the actual standard in music. Affordable, mass-produced, laying out. Basically, 1989 to 2009 is the reign of CDs.
And then that was supplanted by iTunes, by digital music downloads.
The MP3, right?
The MP3, yes. And for the longest time, I sort of fought the MP3 in that, you know, it was not a tangible, physical item that you could touch and hold and place into a device. Like, you know, I wanted to keep the physical around for as long as I could, just in case. I could always make an MP3 out of a CD, but I could not make a CD out of an MP3. I mean, you could backwards engineer it, but you couldn't do it legally, or you couldn't have a legal physical copy.
It was a mixtape if you wanted a mixtape CD, really. Yeah. But yeah.
So,
and if you were
a collector,
collector wants that hard stuff. So as a person in the culture of that era, you wanted your, when your friends came over to your place, can I see your music collection? It didn't mean can I get on your computer and scroll through your iTunes list or your Winamp list back in the day, but could I see, you know, the actual discs you had or the LPs you had or whatever? And today it's just a very different thing. You get on a Spotify account and I have a playlist and I can share it and people can see everything that I have. There you go.
Right. Right. And now, since digital downloads, now we have, for the very first time this year, evidence that streaming is starting to overtake that those statistics. And that means that essentially we've had a 10-year, maybe even less than 10-year, reign.
No, it's about 10 years.
About 10 years.
The iTunes Store. And let's also put something else in there.
Yeah.
Late last year, the herald of the MP3 era, the guys that whipped the llama's ass, they finally shut down their product.
Right.
So before iTunes, Winamp was the jam. Winamp was what you played your MP3s on. iTunes took it over. iTunes showed up on Windows and took that over as well. But Winamp, maybe Sonique, all these things were being developed in order to get the most out of your music collection. And Winamp finally shut its doors. And at the same time that Apple released their iTunes Radio to copy Pandora. So this, I think you're right, this age of digital download music, it's got huge signs in the marketplace that it's not the default any longer.
Yep. And for the longest time, you know, I finally got used to digital downloads, and now most of my collection is on MP3s that I've purchased one way or the other through iTunes or other services, Amazon. And I resisted a streaming service for the longest time because the idea of a streaming service is you stop paying for it, then you don't own it anymore.
Right.
And I wanted to have – I wanted to be able to keep that copy forever. But since joining Spotify – I realize that I'm used to that and I enjoy that, and that is the norm for me. Like, I listen to Spotify more than I listen to music that I have stored on my iPhone. And it's because...
Yeah, because you're getting all that new stuff and you don't have to pay $1.99 per MP3 for it.
Right. I pay a revolving, a recurring fee every month, but for that recurring fee, I get to listen to practically any music that I want to ever, you know, practically anything recorded that Spotify has the license to.
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon because if you think about it, why didn't this happen with Pandora, right? There are a couple things that have been out for a while. Rhapsody was out. Pandora's been out. With Pandora, you can't choose the playlist. They choose it for you based on what you started it out with. Rhapsody was all right, but the library was somewhat limited at first, even though it's much bigger now. But the thing is, the culture wasn't there. It was only until Pandora became wildly popular and mobile devices became wildly popular that people started thinking streaming is the way to go. I don't have tons of storage on my device. I don't want to think about storage, and I want to have somebody else help me figure out what's going on when it comes to the best music out there. I'm getting tired of this track or that track. So Spotify really helped make that transition, along with a pretty inexpensive plan. Now, the big thing is Spotify, just like how Apple changed its situation, just how Winamp went away, there's another indicator on the market, and that's Spotify today, the 8th of January 2014. They released a new update for all their iOS products, and they have one coming out for the Android products, that allows users to gain access to all the music and everything without having to pay, which used to be the way you got access to Spotify's library if you wanted it on mobile. Now they realize that mobile is the future. If you want new users, you're going to have to go to mobile. So they've released an ad-supported version of their mobile product. So here you have all these industry giants moving toward this streaming model, moving away from this storage and download model. And it just goes to show that this is again, the paradigm is shifting. The paradigm is shifting to a place where the cloud has control.
Yep.
And the fact is, if you lost your computer in a fire, up until iCloud in 2011, any music you bought from Apple was gone, and you couldn't get it again. And that could still happen with anything you own. So having the streaming stuff means that you have a lot less to manage, and you get the benefit of other people's ideas. You get to see what your friends are playing and sharing and all this other stuff like that. So this is the future of music. And I think we also owe it to Netflix, who showed us that streaming was the way to go. It's what Hollywood's happy with.
Yep, yep. So I think this is a momentous occasion, a watershed moment, I believe, because this is the first time that we've seen that streaming is the is basically the
new normal.
The new normal, yeah. Yeah. Speaking of things that are watershed moments, Facebook is dead and buried to older teenagers, an extensive European study has found. As the key age group moves on to Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, and whatever else is out there, researching the Facebook use of 16 to 18-year-olds in eight EU countries, a global social media impact study found that as parents and older users saturate Facebook, its younger users are shifting to alternative platforms. One anthropologist, Daniel Miller, wrote, Facebook is not just on the slide, it's basically dead and buried. Mostly, teens feel embarrassed to even be associated with it. Where once parents worried about their children joining Facebook, the children say now that it's that their family, it's their family that insists that they stay there to post about their lives. So yeah, I can see why teens would be, you know, cringing to stay on Facebook.
Yeah, I think Facebook has shown that cringeworthiness is all about your parents seeing that photo of you. I mean, do you remember when Facebook was new to our culture and you hear all these stories about young people not showing up at work because they got drunk? So they'd be like, boss, I can't go to work. And then their boss would see pictures of them crazy drunk the night before. like, I know why you can't go to work. Those kinds of mistakes and so on, they were tied to a generation of people, the millennial generation born in the early 1980s that got jobs in the 90s, the generation that Mark Zuckerberg's a part of, and that people, you know, in the latter part of Generation X later adopted as they wanted to remain relevant. Zuckerberg has stuck with those people. Facebook has stuck with those people. If any of those people want to see babies or you know, the babies of their friends or their sisters or brothers, they want to see the pictures from a wedding, if they want to see that vacation, they want to see all the things that are tied to the trappings of middle age and a better level of income and affluence. That's what Facebook's about. But if you're a teenager and it's just a question of like uncontrollable stupidness and immaturity, you want that Snapchat, you want any of those other networks. You know, Instagram is really simple. It's just pictures. You want the kind of stuff that doesn't have the heaviness, the weight, and the bogged downiness that Facebook has become. It is one of the number one crashing apps on iOS, so it's unstable. It's one of the number one biggest memory hogs on Chrome. So Facebook is not the light and everything it was when we started out looking at it. But for our generation, it's kind of the default. It's just not carrying on that way. So I don't know if that's a terrible thing for Facebook. I think it certainly has some indications for it in the future.
Right. But, I mean, I think it depends on what direction Facebook sees itself going. You know, is it comfortable with where it's at and the audience that it has? Or is it really looking to still try and make itself be a compelling point for, you know, the teens and the new, you know, subscribers, new potential revenue sources and informational sources. So I think it is pretty telling, though. I definitely agree with what you, Dwayne, had to say regarding, you know, how Facebook has become weighed down as software, but also as, you know, the information that it carries and the people that it connects, right? Everyone here is probably connected in some shape or form to family and relatives, and you know, although there are places to try and, you know, limit access to various groups of people, it's still a process and it's time consuming and not something that most teens are probably really interested in.
I think there's a little bit of a an irony in the fact that Facebook was created by Mark Zuckerberg as this home for the hip and the new, a place where only the cool people could hang out, a select circle. And now it's the place where the cool people are running to get away from. But I don't think, having said that, I don't think that Zuckerberg is hurting at all, because essentially he went from an audience of a select few to an audience that is the seventh largest population on Earth.
Yeah, I mean, it's Facebook went from exclusivity to inclusivity, and it was something that Mark Zuckerberg was worried. There were a couple things he was worried about. He was worried about in the beginning. You know, people said, be like MySpace, put ads everywhere.
Right.
Ads are not cool. The privacy controversy showed up. It made Facebook not cool. So there, you know, and now that people know what Facebook does when it comes to its revenue source, he's right. There's a certain cool factor that's gone away. Luckily, he built the audience before that happened. Facebook as legacy definitely had a humongous impact in our lives. And its growth really has to happen overseas now. It really has to become that service that people in Bangladesh, India, and all these emerging – and all the BRIC markets, these are the guys that have to grow Facebook now. Their generations have to grow Facebook. And that's going to be the challenge that it needs.
Right. Okay, let's move on here. Oh, okay, so 6 months after the first revelations appeared in Washington Post and the Britain's Guardian newspaper, NSA leaker Edward Snowden reflected at length on the roots and repercussions of his choice. He said, "For me, in terms of personal satisfaction, the mission's already accomplished." He said, "I already won. As soon as the journalists were able to work, everything that I've been trying to do is validated. Because remember, I didn't want to change society. I wanted to give society a chance to determine if it should change itself. All I wanted was for the public to be able to say, have a say in how they're governed. That's a milestone we left a long time ago. Right now, we're looking at are stretch goals." So what do you think? Do you think that 6 months after the initial leaks from Edward Snowden, that we are at a mission accomplished phase?
Only if you're George W. Bush on the top of that aircraft carrier. I don't think we're in mission accomplished. And that happened in 2004. It's now 2014. So there are some parallels there. The eye-opening, yes. The eye-opening is there. People can see that the world is not as they thought it was. And that's a problem.
Right.
But I think in many ways, if Snowden's right, and it's not about him, it's about us having to do what we have to do. The burden is now on us to figure out if, as a society, we have the wherewithal to either subject all of our personal information to the NSA knowingly or unknowingly, really, or if we want the NSA to just stop what it's doing, it's not necessary, or if we want a happy medium which says, hey, if you're going to collect everything, let us know that you're collecting everything, and we'll behave accordingly. NSA, however, isn't happy with this at all. While, you know, it's all about the idea that, like, we want you to not know what we're doing because we're a spy agency and our efficacy depends on that. And that's not reconciled with the Constitution. The big question is the America of today interested in maintaining its tie to that Constitution? Maybe we're not. Things have changed. We've moved on. Or maybe we are, and we need to have our better angels and our intellectual heavyweights find the best way to sell that to us. But frankly, there's a lot to be said about people just sort of not caring. Regardless, Edward Snowden took a really big risk. It's unclear how that's going to work out for him. But it's been definitely an eye-opening space for anyone who's eye-opening thing for anyone who's in the geek space and in the technology space.
I'd like to believe that this was a loss of innocence moment for America and really for the world, in the same respect that the Watergate break-in was for Richard Nixon back in the 60s, that this is a moment where people are have realized that their leaders, the people who they placed trust in, the people who represent that which is their country, have essentially lied to them, and have lost, and they've betrayed their trust. Let me talk about that for a moment here on this next story. So going back, we didn't report on this last year, but late last year, Reuters reported that RSA, one of the most influential firms in the computer security industry, received $10 million in a deal that allowed the NSA to incorporate a known flawed random number generator into their encryption products. And RSA has since denied that claim. Security expert Bruce Schneier wrote, "We no longer know whom to trust. This is the greatest damage the NSA has done to the internet, and it will be the hardest to fix. This sort of thing can destroy our country. Trust is essential in our society. If we can't trust either our government or the corporations that have intimate access into so much of our lives, society suffers. Study after study demonstrates the value of living in a high-trust society and the costs of living in a low-trust one. Rebuilding trust is not easy, as anyone who's been betrayed or have been betrayed by a friend or a lover knows, but the path involves transparency, oversight, and accountability. Transparency first involves coming clean, not a little bit at a time, not only when you have to, but complete disclosure about everything. Then it involves continuing disclosure. No more secret rulings by secret courts about secret laws. No more secret programs whose costs and benefits remain hidden." So I thought that was a very insightful comments by Bruce Schneier, who should know. You know, he's been doing this for decades now.
Trust is essential to any functioning relationship, including a relationship of free people with its government.
Yeah,
it's you know, I think this is really the tip of the iceberg, right? We know the news, and there may be more to come, but now it's how do we react? What sort of change comes out, and how do we move forward from there?
And where's the ire also? Is the ire going to be in the American people? I know I've seen Rand Paul get angry at this. He's a conservative right senator, I think from Kentucky. I know I've seen Google get angry. I mean, Rand Paul got angry from the civil liberties perspective, freedom, America. Google and those other tech companies sat in front of Obama ostensibly to talk about healthcare, but really they didn't even let that happen. According to the news reports, they said, what the hell's going on with the NSA? This is keeping us from doing business abroad. So they're angry on that front. Where's the big sort of lobby to say this needs to change in a big way? Obviously,
you know, I think it's coming.
The courts have been fighting.
Yeah.
And the one court says this is illegal, one court says it doesn't. And then the commission that the president put together says we got to do some changes. So where's the actual political will going to come from? What do you guys
think? It's coming. I think the tech giants are going to be the standard bearers on that ire, because they've been personally affected, and it's hit them in their pocketbook, in their bottom line. And I think they're leading the charge, and they're also going to, I think we're going to see in the coming months a propaganda push by the tech giants to publicize what the NSA has been doing.
So some sort of lobbying, some sort of PR and lobbying.
Yep.
I guess I could see that. Is that going to be enough? What do you think, Tosin?
You know what? I think some legislators are actually finally getting a hint at it, but it's still difficult to really tell if a majority are, because if you do recall the earlier stories where you know, you see all these people who are just bored out of their minds in these briefings, or just don't go to them.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of telling. So I don't know. It's hard to say.
And some of them may not be in their own political interests to get involved at all. They've already cast their
lot. If the NSA is sitting there and it's got 200, you know, it's got like 10,000 workers in your state, is it in your best interest to try to shut that program down?
Right.
You know,
right.
There's that. If your state is one that provides drones that use actionable intelligence based on this stuff, are you going to use that as your excuse? There is a sort of idea here that, hey, look, this all sucks. It's terrible. But what else can we do? The protection of the people comes first. And that's something we have to think about. Basically, I just think of Jean-Luc Picard saying that Julian Bashir saying that we can't protect the Federation if we forget what the Federation stands for. It's no Deep Space Nine reference. So it's just a weird thing.
All right, we're going to take one last break, and when we come back, a walking cube. Our drill down video of the week is next. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sarcini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. Researchers at the Institute for Dynamic Systems and Control at Zurich have created a small robotic cube that can autonomously jump up and balance on any one of its corners. And we have the YouTube video we're going to attach to our show notes to demonstrate this. It's called the Cubely, and this latest version of the Cubely can jump up, balance, and even walk using internal momentum wheels to transfer energy to the entire cube and cause it to jump up. So it's essentially, it's got these wheels inside that spin up and then create this momentum and then suddenly stop suddenly, and the momentum from stopping suddenly causes it to balance on one of its corners, and then it kicks the motors back up again, spins the wheels back up again in a sort of like a gyroscopic manner, and keeps the cube balanced on one of its corners that way, or even sort of walk across the room by alternately speeding up momentum, stopping suddenly, and speeding up and stopping. It's fascinating to watch. It seems like, I can see the future applications of this being where you have these self-assembling groups of these blocks.
Just like the Small Invasion on Doctor Who Season 6.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah,
I mean, that's really where it's going. You're going to have these little blocks everywhere. They're just going to show up, and then they're going to do stuff to us, just like, you know, the doctor told us, you know, what happened.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating to watch. And this is, we're just scratching the surface on this. I mean, this is just early days from this for this technology. I can't wait to see what happens in the next, you know, 5 or 10 years with this. We're going to have something that's going to be really practical that we can, that we'll see put to use in everyday life. And seeing this kind of technology at its sort of nascent form really thrills me, because you can just see the potential, and you know that it's going to scale pretty quickly from here on out.
If the commie Europeans let it.
Or you may see dancing cube dolls for kids.
Or Dancing with the Stars, cube style.
You know, I think about that every time I think about the massive, enormous potential that was the laser, and now my 9-year-old daughter uses it to play with her kitten. So,
yeah, but at the same time, the laser, there were like UN conventions against the use of lasers in warfare, which really slowed down the private industry's reason to do the research.
Yes, well, there you go. But in a way, aren't you glad? I mean, I don't want to be shot by a laser.
No, I mean, I guess I'm glad. It's just, you know, I know, the Europeans often move in ways that are very, not capitalistic. So I don't know, you know, if the technology is really going to make it out. A lot of things happen in the lab that don't see a nice, consumer focus. So that's the one thing to worry about.
All right. Well, I think that's it for our show, except for going around the table here. And I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can check me out at twitter.com/DwayneD, or you can check me out at DwayneD.net or flavors.me/DwayneD, rather, where you can see everything I'm doing. And yeah, those are the two big places. You could also catch me here on the Drill Down every week.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. And you can also find other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find me at mrbabyman.com and mrbabyman on Facebook and Twitter. Just Google Mr. Baby Man. You know, that's my social network handle, and you'll find that all my stuff online there. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on the Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on our site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of the Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.